hppodcraft.com.
If I say I was just engaged to be married, you will forgive my thus intruding my own affairs for a moment, because through being engaged, I was landed into the most curious happening of my life. I had been in France some 2.5 years before the bit of shell met me, which landed me back in Blighty, with a leg that was not going to be of much more service to me. I had had many and varied experiences in France, horrors, of course, but of these we do not often speak. Much of deep interest, and much which goes to the furthering of knowledge of many kinds, knowledge which has led thousands of men to get down to realities and to shun forevermore the superficial shams which made up existences before 1914. But this is not a war story, except insofar that it transformed me, an officer in a well-known regiment, into a very ordinary civilian with a game leg and fathoms deep in love with the sweet child who nursed me. Elsie Falconer was my nurse. In the stately home of England, in which I and my mangled leg found ourselves after a long, troublesome journey.
That was the opening of Outside the House by Bessie Kiffin Taylor. It's a story we're pulling out in an anthology plundering June here at HP Podcraft. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, the science officer of this expedition to conduct strange studies of strange stories. Am I a science officer?
Are you the science officer? That's just what I thought I'd assign you in the notes there. What do you want to be?
I do. I have a teal next-gen tunic.
Yeah.
So yes, that's science or medical, but
right.
Who wants to be a doctor?
Well, I'm the mental doctor. I'm going to be the empath with all the psychic powers that you need to have in any strange science fiction story expedition. So that's going to be me. Who was that reader?
That's Marty Japsen.
Yes.
We've had him on the show many times. He is a very talented guy. He is a science entertainer and educator, edutainment, if you will. He's going to be appearing this month at the Cheltenham Science Festival. You'll have to go online. We'll put links to it in the show notes where you can get tickets for that stuff. But he's also doing a show called Zap on the morning of Sunday, the 13th of June. So you want to check that out as well. But he's got a lot of great stuff going on. The pandemic, the restrictions are being lifted. So Marty is out there again doing his awesome science stuff.
That almost sounded like cautionary the way he said that. The restrictions are being lifted and Marty's out there again. Be careful, folks. Well, I'm glad that he's out there again. I was thinking about it because I was doing the little science officer empath thing. You know, if you had Marty on the expedition, he would be the mysterious guest for that episode. He would be
the guy
who shows up, and the whole adventure would hinge on whatever his behavior was. And, you know, if I think about Marty, yeah, that is exact. Well, how come he hasn't been on Star Trek yet? He is just that guy. I don't know why.
He's that guy.
But he gets beamed aboard in the cold open, and he's got a device, or maybe, you know, he's mad at somebody. You don't really. And then the whole episode, at the end, he's made friends with the captain, and you're sad to see him go.
That's Marty in a nutshell.
What about this author? Who's this author?
I could find out very little about Bessie Kiffin Taylor, mostly just the basics from the speculative fiction database. But then I compared that to what I found in the anthology, and it was wrong.
Uh-oh.
She doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. So she's, you know, we're going off the beaten path here. I got the story from the collection Weird's Women 2. It was Weird's Women 1, or Weird's Women was the first one, the story that we had last week. I said Weird Women or Women of the Weird or something. I got the title wrong. It's Women's apostrophe S Weird. And then this is from Women's Weird too.
For some reason, I feel like if you go searching for a collection of weird fiction by women, you're not going to be aghast at the selections available to you. I think it's going to work out.
You're going to be able to find it.
Yeah, this isn't like I walked into this stereo equipment store and I don't know what to do. I think you're going to walk in and go, I want a Weird Women, and they already have it in their hand, the booksellers. Yeah. Here you go.
Well, this is the bio from the book. Bessie Kiffin Taylor, she was born in 1869, died in 1922. She was born in Liverpool, the daughter of Thomas Cope and Sarah Davies Cope of Huyton. After her father's death in 1884, her mother married John A. Wilcox, journalist and later proprietor of the Liverpool Courier in 1888. In 1892, Bessie married Gerald Kiffin Taylor, who became a member of Parliament in 1910. He resigned his seat in order to serve in the First World War, where he became a brigadier general and later served as director of housing in Lancashire. The couple lived in Heswell from their marriage until Bessie's death in 1922. According to a brief obituary in the Hull Daily Mail on the 29th of August, 1922, she was well known in literary circles as a writer of articles and stories, and was a keen sportswoman, fond of angling and motoring. The obituary references From Out of the Silence that came out in 1920, her one known collection of supernatural fiction, as well as a play that was titled Rosemary. I want to know more about this love of angling and motoring, though. This really got me hooked.
There's always some stupid thing like that in obituaries. And I know that they are very tough to write because you can't encapsulate somebody in a short passage. And sometimes I think, why even try? Because it winds up being so bizarre. Mm-hmm. When you describe things they physically do. You know, I just read about a woman who passed away. This was just a couple weeks ago. And it made the news because she was over 100, which is the reason I was reading it. And she was local. But right in the opening, it said she enjoyed eating half a banana every morning. It really stuck with me because I went, surely there is more to this woman's life in 100 years than her half masticated banana. Like, and then it bothered me because, like, what happens to the other half of the banana? It's likely she has caregivers or maybe family lives around her or something, but probably there's not somewhere every day, someone there every day to eat the other half. So I'm just imagining half wrap. It doesn't keep overnight.
No.
There's that sickly sweet banana smell in the kitchen all the time. And there's probably half a banana laying out. There's probably a lot more to Bessie than what's listed here. The other thing that made me laugh about the obituary is that she's well known in literary circles as a writer of articles and stories. Well, I hope so. Because otherwise, what else do you get known for in literary circles besides that? Somebody who's too drunk to write a word. Or a real crazy person that's easy to make fun of for your material.
She's that lady that does that great dance where she crosses her arms over her knees and it looks like her hands are crossing. You know, that move? She's known for doing that move in the dancing, and that's why love her.
What a better obituary that would be, whether true or not. So, by the way, Twitter users may have seen this. Speaking of obituaries when they can be helpful.
Yes, yes.
One solved a puzzle for us that probably we could have solved on our own. But friend of the show Norman Lloyd passed away.
Yeah.
People may remember him. I call him friend of the show because I ate dinner next to him once and he talked about loving Dean, which was very funny.
I love Dean.
Don't get me wrong. I love Dean. I love Dean. Well, Norman passed away.
106.
106 years old.
Wow.
He lived through the first pandemic. That's how old he was.
Oh, God.
So was able to offer information this time because he lived through it before. As I said, when I sat next to him, he talked about playing tennis with Charlie Chaplin, et cetera. It was really cool.
Wow.
This obituary revealed the identity of Dean.
Yes.
As I was reading this long obituary, I thought, I wonder if somebody named Dean will say something about him. And boom, there he was, Dean Hargrove, legendary television producer. He himself is 82 years old.
Wow.
Created a little show called Matlock. Andy Griffith's show, Matlock. He also used to write for Man from U.N.C.L.E. And he's a very accomplished TV producer. So Dean deserves the love that he got from Norman. And hopefully he hangs out until 106. Back to Bessie. The only bio I found mentioned was that she only wrote the one volume of supernatural stories and that her work has been frequently compared to that of E.F. Benson, which I very much agree with. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily in a good way. I have to admit, I was pretty bored by this story. You liked it, right?
I did like it, actually. I was really into it.
Well, the writing suggested a lot of things to me, and it kind of made me think, you know, it's interesting how one's expectations can really color what you take from a story. So reading this made me think about this. You know, we often read things for the show a bit randomly, as we did here, and so my expectation going in is not that I'm necessarily going to enjoy something, but that I'm going to be talking about it with you. That's it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it really opens up a different, very like non-Rotten Tomatoes way of appreciating something. It's so rare that I sit down thinking, okay, this is going to solve my anxieties or transport me away from my crappy life or put me in touch with some elusive childhood feeling of adventure. Mm. I just take these things how they are. They're short stories, so that's a little easier to do than a Star Wars movie or something. I am very bored with this story.
Sure.
But it made me think of a lot of different things.
Yeah, being able to take something good out of something and not having to judge it as a whole. Like, I read this story, maybe it's not the best story I've ever read, but there's certain parts of it that captivate me or make me think about something, and I take that away from the story. And ultimately, to me, that's a good story. If it does something like that, if it gives me, you know, I can nitpick about some plots or some elements or facts or things that are, or maybe some of the writing's a little slow, whatever. But I still found something that was of value in the story. And I think a lot of people, especially in this internet age, are looking to tear stuff down. They're not trying to find value in stuff. They just want to dismiss things. And that's really frustrating because there's value in a lot of things.
Absolutely. If at the very least, it's just what does in the, you know, because I think this book came out in 1920. So we're talking pre-20s female writer doing supernatural fiction.
Yeah.
That's based around World War I. Just from a historical perspective, it's really interesting to read something like that. But to your point, too, I think with scoring and grading and these things, there's like a competition that's put over art where something needs to fall so that something else can take its place. And I just also don't believe, I don't understand this competitive structure to things other than to sell things. A sports narrative is really helpful. So that's why we have these awards shows. And that's why we you have like something will become the shitty movie du jour, whether it's Cats or whatever, where everybody agrees, let's beat up on this right now. And all of those things are very influenced by, I think, the way media positions winners and losers as a way to take your money. And it's a lot less a life that is made better by working the enjoyment of culture and art into it. Let's jump into the story.
Our story begins with this guy, Major John Longworth, a British soldier who fought in World War I. He took some shrapnel in the leg and was out of action. But his leg is now permanently injured. He's got a bum leg. But while healing up back in England, he fell in love with his nurse, Elsie Falconer. You know, he's a wounded soldier, so you could say it's Falconer and the Wounded Soldier. Boom.
You could say that. If you said it in 1920, people would be like, yeah, that is what it is. I don't understand. But yes, that would kill with the Disney Plus audience. Oh, he's very British, this guy, and it's not just because his name's John Longworth. He also won't describe the injury to his leg other than to say it's a game leg. I don't even think I saw the shrapnel part that you referenced. Maybe he did say that. I think maybe later he says it's mangled, but that could range from a limp to the whole lower half is in a field somewhere in France. He just wouldn't say it. And that permeates the story, this idea of nobody saying what's on their mind or what's really happening.
You said that you were bored with the story. When I read it, I was just into it. I just totally was on board. I liked the characters. I liked the way that she wrote. However, when I started going back to do notes, I got real bored.
Yeah.
Breaking it down, that's when I found myself not, because not much really happens in this story.
Well, that's when you start getting into what's literary and what's not, I think, though, right? Because it was a pleasant diversion for you, which is what a lot of stories are just meant to be. And this one is a by-the-book ghost story, honestly. And in that respect, it doesn't really achieve what we might say is more high art, which means that when you unpack it a little more on a second reading, you find out that there's other things going on and that there's a measure of depth to it. And I think that's when you can say, well, this isn't a better or worse story, but this is a story that's going to get you more involved in a more rich way, you know, and that's the competition, I guess. But also, I like diversions.
Yeah.
You know, if you write a story, it's like one guy punched another guy. That's a pretty good story to me.
Yeah.
Depending.
It says here about Elsie. She was a joy to look at, to talk to joke with, but she was not a nurse. Some women are born nurses. Some have nursing thrust upon them and some achieve nursing. Elsie was none of these, but she was very sweet, very sympathetic. And it was a delight to watch her little fingers bandage my poor leg. Though I would not for worlds have let her guess the agonies I endured until in her time off, I could capture the sister and beg a little relief, saying my bandages were not quite tight enough. Sister would smile and, being a sport, kept her own counsel. It's a great character painting of this woman and his feelings for her. She's flawed, but yet he still loves her. And there's just some real warmth in the writing. I like that. I like this sweet stuff.
I did too. And I also thought it was very human because he's ignoring her mistakes because he's smitten with her. I just feel like, you know what, later you're going to be having a conversation with somebody and going, I should have known it when she couldn't get my bandage right. This was a huge mistake. You know, that's not good if she's being careless with your leg injury. Let me tell you, I don't know. I think she's cute, but you got to think about this. And you're not doing any favors by hiding her incompetence from her at all. You are creating a bad relationship dynamic.
Now, this is something about World War I as well, that it really paints a picture of this time where a lot of these women had to become nurses because there was nobody else to do it. Like, Elsie's from a wealthy family.
Yeah.
Could you possibly imagine in our day and age where rich women would have to become nurses?
No.
No.
I can't imagine wealthy people going into the military or doing anything for public service at all these days. I mean, you know, as something that would just be socially accepted.
I mean, that's how bad the wars were. World War One, World War Two. Rich people had to fight in them.
Yeah, but
there
I know.
There was no choice.
It's something you don't think about, but when you see something like this, it's all about rich people having to open up. This woman's from a wealthy family and she's a nurse. And then also it references all of the different estates and buildings where possibly the younger generations were wiped out by the war. Mm-hmm. So there's rooms available. But I think also in the face of such mass trauma, you couldn't be sitting on your Downton Abbey estate with eight people living in the house, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
it was your duty to the country and your crown to open up and make those places into hospitals or halfway houses or resting homes or whatever you want to call them. And probably was the death knell for those kinds of estates as well. I think most of them are public buildings now, right? Where you pay and you go and you get to go see the whole stuff.
Yeah, lots of them. John made buds with this guy in the bed next to him, Percy Hesketh. He was a boon companion, and they had this electricity. He says, it was one of those friendships which comes into some lives at first meeting of the eyes, without a word spoken, something that makes one's innermost mind think the words at last, as if one knew that into one's life had come something hitherto wholly lacking.
There was a hint of the supernatural in this friendship that's established here as well, because it says, as the weeks of our hospital life passed on, we drew even closer, making a compact that if either should fall on the battlefield, we would endeavor to communicate with the other. It's sort of like that deal Houdini made with his wife, Bessie.
Right.
And I just couldn't wait until this friendship and this pact were all paid off in this story. That's going to be great.
Really great friends. But at the end of his 3-month stay, he was released and off to meet his future wife's family. He was to go ahead on his own, and she was going to continue to help at the hospital for a few more days. Weird to go to some stranger's house, never having met any of them. Usually you have your future wife to help you navigate family dynamics, but no, not for John.
You're killing me, because if you've ever gone to see The Room, anytime Tommy Wiseau says, she's my future wife, everybody in the audience goes, wife of the future! It took me a second to wrap my head around what's going on here, but yeah, he goes off to meet her family without her.
Without her.
Hell no. That's bad for everybody.
Yes.
Because what else are you going to talk about if you don't know these people? You're going to talk about the person who's not there. Would you be comfortable if your new girlfriend went to hang out with your parents and they all jawed about what you were like? No way.
Oh, no.
Especially early in a relationship, you got to have some time to present that idealized version of yourself before mom and dad ruin it. This is crazy.
Yeah.
Also, given what we learn later in the story about this property, why would she do that?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about with the bandage. If she's careless about your leg, she's probably going to be careless about a whole bunch of other stuff.
Mm.
And guess what? That bears out.
So the day he was leaving, Elsie got a bit sketchy. She says, John, you will try and like it, won't you? For my sake, don't let anything worry you, will you? Nothing could really do you any harm. And he's like, yeah, okay, whatever. And then as he's on his journey, he's like, wait a minute, what was she talking about? Nothing could do me any harm? That's a strange thing to say. Chalk it up to nerves.
Why not be explicit, though, on her part? Because, look, there's a lot of people not saying things in this story. I guess I'm to accept that that's just culturally what's going on. And people don't communicate in life. That's true.
Mm.
But it's a little about that conversation we had recently about creating fake obstacles in a story in an insulting way.
Mm.
And, like, you better find a way to make it believable that nothing's being communicated here, because this is like an enforced farce. Somebody has to have a misunderstanding. Well, she's going to explain if they're getting married.
Yeah.
I just do not buy that she would send him there by himself and not say there's a spooky garden lake that might kill you, because they're going to get married. I don't know. I don't buy it. I do not buy it.
I mean, there is a thing in English culture where people don't talk about things and they just sort of keep their heads down and focus on whatever is right in front of them. So I didn't think that was, especially 100 years ago, I feel like people were probably even more like that then.
I think they definitely were about affairs of the heart. I'm talking about a supernatural garden that might murder the person you're gonna. I'm not saying that she is explicit about it, maybe. Maybe she doesn't go, there's ghosts that live there. But is she gonna say more than nothing can really do you any? Well, okay, so when she says nothing can really do you any harm, maybe she doesn't actually know that this could drive him crazy or whatever.
Yeah.
But I just feel like more if she's sending him off by himself. Like, what could be the outcome she likes to have happened? Because she knows he's going to run into this stuff. Otherwise, she wouldn't have said anything. I don't know.
Yeah.
You tell me.
Yeah,
we'll keep going.
No. I mean, you're right. She could have easily just said, they're going to do some weird stuff. Just go with it.
Or just don't go outside. I know it'll seem weird. When I get there, I'll explain to you.
Yes, but she can't. That's part of the rules of this thing, which are a little strange. Anyway, as he comes up the drive, there are all these huge trees. This house is gorgeous, but there's this part of the lawn that's about 6 feet lower than the rest of the grounds. Maybe it was a drained lake or something, but it's lovely. It has all these flower beds.
This would be a good spot for that patch of vampire ground Like that story we did, the transfer by Algernon Blackwood. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that a lot. I almost wrote down The Sunken Land as the story, but that's quite different, although that would be an appropriate title for this story, since it is about a patch of sunken land.
And there are a bunch of people out on the lawn enjoying afternoon tea. Two people come up to him, an older man, that's Mr. Falconer, and Elsie's sister, Maud. She greets him, but then says to her little brother, Bob, in a whisper, "He'll never stand it, Bob. He isn't the sort, but mum's the word." So the kid, Bob, he's quite a character. He comes up to John and says, "Bum leg, eh? Rotten luck. Got any good war stories? I see you got your purple and white ribbon." And John says, "Lots of chaps who will never get it have earned that bit of ribbon better than I did."
Complimenting a soldier on their medals never seems to quite hit the mark. But you say he's a fun character. I thought maybe this guy was going to be more fun. Just like I thought the fiance's older sister, Maud, would be an interesting complication because she kind of resembles the younger sister but seems more forward and edgy. And I thought maybe she's going to be the scandalous one or she's going to come. Nah, it doesn't matter. These people, like the other people you're about to meet, are just background characters. So I was a little mad that I even had to learn their names because they don't do anything, just like that friend that we met in the hospital.
Yeah. I mean, everything you're saying is totally true.
It's just my complaint. Yeah.
Now, Bob takes John to Elsie's mom, who calls her mater, showing off his fancy schooling by using Latin. She makes a fuss over John, which is very motherly, gets him a nice place to sit, brings him some tea. They have some war scones. War scones are scones that were made without most of the ingredients that you would normally have for scones. So they were kind of bread-like things just because war was going on and they were having to ration. But they did have some strawberries. And he goes over all the guests. There's Mr. and Mrs. Falconer, Maud, Bob, Captain McLean, and his sister Nora, the Reverend L. Roberts. He's this middle-aged man. Lottie, this little girl. She's six. Alex and Ken, they're twins. They're older than her.
Yeah, the sister of Captain... You said McLean, which is probably what it is, but it says Captain McLean. McLean. Okay, so you gave me a captain. Then you gave me a captain with an amazingly badass name. And then it turns out that the captain's sister Nora is the governess to these three youngest children, two of which are cold as ice twins.
Yeah.
There's so much potential there.
Yeah.
The invitation for this garden party said, apparently you are cordially invited to disappoint Chad. Please arrive and do nothing for 30 pages.
So everyone is keen to talk with John. They're very friendly. As the sun goes down, everybody starts packing it in. This is something that I'm a bit confused about in the writing of this story. They say that the sun is going down at 5, but it's the summertime. Later on, it says it's July. And I live up north.
Yeah.
And in July, it doesn't get dark until like 11 o'clock at night.
And oh, wow.
They're south. It's not that much of a difference. It's only like a 5-hour drive to get down south. It probably gets dark like 9 o'clock.
I mean, there's still clear. I was confused about it, too, although there are lots of references to the light. So I think, you know, it says the sun began to sink behind the trees in a pink glow that lit up the house as if a pink limelight were thrown upon it. So I think it's kind of the best part of the summer day when the direct sunlight is blocked because it's gone down the horizon a bit. So it's blocked by buildings or trees, but there's still heat and light and sweetness in the air, which is why you would want to hang out at that time of day in a garden. But then sometimes it seemed like, yeah, that sun was bleeding on the edge of the horizon about to go down any minute.
Well, 5 is too early for John, and he asks everyone, why won't they stay out a bit later? Bob says it's a bit late to stay out in this garden, and he hems and haws and says it's because of the damp, as he's obviously making this reason up on the spot. John tries to get the parson to stay and chat a while longer, but he makes excuses as well and leaves. Everyone leaves except for Miss Dorcas, the governess. She was sewing comfort bags for wounded men. As it gets a little bit later, she goes in. She says, I'm sure you'll come in when you've had enough. And he says, enough what? And she says, the garden. So he's out there by himself thinking it's really strange that they just left a guy who's disabled out in the garden all on his own.
Yeah, I didn't think of it till you wrote your note. I left a guy who's disabled out in the garden on his own. That's not really explicitly stated, but that's what it is. You just made it so much more sad by phrasing it that way. It's like, that is like every Oscar movie that I know is good and I will never watch because it's just sad. It's always more of a white chick's night around here. I'm not really going to do that. That's what this guy is.
But it's a nice evening, so he just relaxes a bit. This old servant comes out and starts picking up some of the dishes. He asks John if he wants to come into the house. John finally gets it, and he goes, okay, fine, I'll go in. And the old servant tries to help him up. As he does, he picks up a tray of stuff as well, you know, dishes and things. And as they're leaving, the old man stumbles, slips on something, but he doesn't know what, and all the cups and things drop and break on the ground. The butler's just helping John, and he goes, well, what about the cups? Are you going to pick those up? And he says, the broken cups can wait. We'll get those tomorrow.
Which you might mistake. This is a very humorless butler. I kind of didn't like him because our main character made a joke about being wounded that was kind of maudlin. And the butler was like, that's not funny. We got to go. Y'all business.
As he leans on this butler, they're both struggling to make it across the lawn. He says, we must have had every appearance of a couple of very drunken retrobates struggling home after a wildly dissipated night.
I am aware that I was said to be walking across a smooth expanse of velvety lawn without so much as a croquet hoop to trip me up. But seemingly, I was struggling through a close tangle of strong briars which entwined themselves round me as if they were endowed with sense, and each successive one was struggling to twist and pull harder than the other. That was my impression. Yet on that expanse of smooth green, there was not a single item to suggest such a state of affairs. Slowly, slowly, inch by inch, with the perspiration streaming from us, we reached at last the steps, mounted the first, and were confronted by a heavy pressure as if to force us back.
So, the big dramatic set piece of this first half of the story is two guys in a garden miming Walk Against the Wind. That's what it is, basically. And I have to say, that was a real hook for me in terms of getting involved with finishing this story. It's like, now more than ever, I want this to end.
Yeah, for me, I was hooked. I thought it was neat the way that they described how the grass was kind of wrapping around their feet, but it wasn't. You know, like you're pulling on something is got you, but there's actually nothing there. And that
you sound so much like a theater instructor right now. Keep going. And now it's cold. Now you're walking through Play-Doh. I don't know how that happened, but you are. You're walking through Play-Doh. Okay, now it's oil. Okay, now you're just getting hugged by puppies. Hugged by puppies. Roll around. You love it. It's the best. There's a sunken garden. You're walking through a sunken garden. Excuse me. Why? The puppies were more fun than that. What a terrible idea. Wow, my fake student is even mad about this story.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great diversion. It was a pleasant story. And we're not done with it. That's the thing. Yeah. We're spending two episodes on the story because it's pretty long.
It's pretty long. And like I say, it made me think about a lot of stuff. I'll leave you with an insight, actually, and we could pick it up for next time. When they do get into the house, the sister kind of helps him. And there's a comment that's made. She helped me up with a good, strong pull, the kind of pull our young women are beginning to acquire since they metaphorically took their coats off. And this is, of course, to your point earlier, that everybody really had to work on the war effort. Mm-hmm. Women had to give up fancy work and crochet for making shells, milking cows, and tilling the land. And I just thought, fancy work? Like what? Birthing and raising kids? What do you think the fancy work was? And of course, he means wealthy women.
He means wealthy women, yes.
I was thinking about the word fancy, and it actually made me aware of a colloquialism that perhaps only I have, although maybe you share this.
I probably do.
Because I think of things as fancy, and then I think of things as extra fancy. And now, extra fancy is on ketchup bottles. On Heinz ketchup, it says that this is extra fancy. And since I was a little kid, that always made me laugh. Like things at the dinner table with your French fries and burgers. Okay, but now it's extra fancy because you're putting ketchup on it. So fancy is what this story calls fancy, like a garden party. That's fancy. We all know what that is. It's a black dress. It's a tuxedo. It's an event. And then extra fancy to me, when I mentally think of something as extra fancy, it's like I made a sandwich and I'm going to cut it into fours. Like that's extra fancy. It's that little touch you put on a normal thing to make it better. Like the other night I was excited to watch my HBO show. I'm watching Mayor of Easttown and I took a shower for the television show. Right? I took a shower, comfortable clothes, sat down, made it into a little event that hour. That was extra fancy what I did. So it's like, it's not fancier than fancy. Fancy is fancier than extra fancy, but extra fancy will make your life better.
That made sense to me.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have, but it totally did.
Because fancy, those are the big events. The Oscars, the prom. These are the fancy events, the aspirational things, the award ceremony. But do those things make you happier? The fancy things? It's something to look forward to, but it's being extra fancy that makes a life worth living.
Man, you really nailed it.
I'm going to leave you with that for this week, and then we'll revisit next week when we come back to the second part of Outside the House.
I want to thank Marty Johnson for reading like a champion. That guy has got the goods.
Yes, Marty, thank you so much for coming on this show. I know that a lot of Star Trek and Star Trek adjacent shows have been asking you to come on as a guest star, and you took the time to read for us instead of doing that. When you are done with this, though, I really do think that a Doctor Who, maybe... Just a science fiction show. Marty shows up. You know what I'm saying, right?
I know exactly what you're saying, yeah. I want to thank some of our supporters, people on Patreon that are giving us some of their hard-earned cash to keep this train rolling.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Josh Currier.
I want to thank Donna Bellafuil Essex.
I'd like to thank Thomas DeBorn.
I'd like to thank Zachariah William Schoenke.
John Fitzmaurice, thank you.
Teratologically Fabulous, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank David W. Grimm.
I'd like to thank Nohelia Moldestad.
Jacqueline Curtis, thank you.
And finally, Danish Snake. Thank you so much. The best of the snakes. That's all we have. We're going to be back with more Outside the House. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lacking.
HPPodcraft.com.